Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Hello from Bristol City Centre. We're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world accessing the show on the internet. We have three studio guests this week. Monica Margaret Jones from Viva Palestina. She went on the recent convoy to Gaza in Palestine. Dave Barnby is here to talk about the European movement. We're also going to talk to Simon Chapman. We're also expecting a live phone call from Unite Against Fascist Movement about the forthcoming march in Bolton by the English Defence League. The features this week are by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling as ever. And we've also got Malcolm Greaves reading another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Carter is here, our resident bard, to read us his latest satirical poem. And Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and Song of the Week. Now I'd like to introduce our first guest, Monica Margaret Jones from the Viva Palestina organisation. Hello.
Hello.
So how long have you been a member of the Viva Palestina organisation?
I think I should just set that straight. I'm actually a member of the Bristol Gaza Link.
Okay.
And Bristol Gaza Link joined with Viva Palestina, which is a national organisation founded by George Galloway. So I'm really more a member of BG Link than I am of Viva Palestina.
Okay, but you're sort of brothers in arms, so to speak, with the same sort of cause.
Oh, yes. It's not a faction fight. Just I wanted to clarify that. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So have you been on a convoy abroad before in such a similar manner? Is this a first-time event for you? Or?
I've been to Palestine three times before, but this was the first time to go with a convoy.
Okay.
That was something different.
So how long ago was the first time you went?
First time I went to Palestine was in 2001.
Okay.
And we went to Jerusalem and then to Gaza, which at that time was open. The Israelis closed the border and, you know, then the rockets started coming over from Gaza.
Yeah.
That happened gradually. They gradually closed this net around Gaza.
Yeah.
And then after the Hamas party was elected, then they really put the pressure on Gaza so that now you can't even get paper or stationery or building materials.
What is your sort of personal history of sort of politics? Were you involved in politics a lot previous to this, or is this just sort of a specific issue that you're particularly interested in? Or?
Well, I'd done a bit of activism, a lot of it sort of direct action around road protests and anti-nuclear things.
Yeah.
And before that in America with the Central America campaign,
you
know, the supporting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, particularly.
So how did you find, I mean, in the nearly 10 years between... 9 years between you first being in Palestine and now, how did you find it had changed and what hadn't changed?
The awareness has grown in Britain, and that is, and I think across the world, and this is one of the wonderful things that is now happening. When I came from teaching in Egypt in the early 70s, it was very difficult even to say the Palestinians have a point of view. Even to say that was to be suspected of anti-Semitism, and, you know, you were somehow a Jew hater if you said that.
Okay.
I don't think most people now would make that mistake, and many, many Jews, actually, would be very supportive of justice for the Palestinians. And there were Jewish people on the convoy, quite a few of them.
Okay, so why do you think that was? I mean, is that sort of an active part on the Israelis to try and sort of make sure that their point of view dwarfs others, or is it just general ignorance? Or
No, it's certainly not coming from the Israeli state, which is becoming more and more repressive and violent. And I think even the US State Department is getting pretty fed up, actually, with the present Israeli government.
Yeah.
You know, they keep putting settlements and talking about negotiations with the Palestinians. I mean, they're just not playing the game. No, I think it's far more a gradual building of awareness, lobbying, campaigning, doing petitions, but also demonstrating. People going to the West Bank, more than to Gaza, but going to the West Bank, olive picking, meeting people, meeting Jewish dissident groups like Jews for Justice and Rabbis for Human Rights, and coming back and telling their stories. And there's been a gradual building of awareness. And then, of course, the bombing of Gaza last year was a huge turning point, I think. December of, what am I trying to say here? It was January, wasn't it, of 2009,
yep.
That appalling bombing in which two-thirds of the casualties, the deaths, were civilian. And I think that woke many people up to the nature of the Israeli state. So that our quarrel is not with Jewish people, obviously.
Yeah.
It's not even with individual Israelis. What we are saying is, as with apartheid South Africa, there's an evil regime and that has got to change. Okay.
What was your experience of being taking part in the convoy when, I understand, the convoy came under or sort of attack in a sort of locked compound?
Yeah, yes.
You were part of that, actually. What was that like?
I'm laughing because I was asleep at the time. I think what happened was, and in fact, one of the port staff, because we were camping with our vehicles in a port, 200 vehicles, if you can imagine that, in a little enclave by the sea. And when I spoke to the port staff in the morning, I said, you people have been really nice to us. And they were, and we used their bathroom, and, you know, they were very kind.
Yeah.
And I said, the people outside weren't so nice last night. He said, oh, no, madame, that was not the people of El Arish. That was, and he patted his shoulder, which is a way of saying they were police. And there were plainclothes police who had come as provocateurs to stir things up.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, our people reacted and threw bricks back. But I was asleep at the time and I just heard all this confused noise. And I said to the people in the van next door, can't you keep the noise down? And then I looked on the ground outside my tent and the ground was wet. And I said, what's been going on here? You've been throwing water bottles. And they said, oh, no, it was the police when they fired their water cannon. It's all gone quiet now. I said, water cannon? What water cannon? Don't give me that rubbish. Yeah. And I went back to sleep.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned earlier, I mean, the Israeli regime is evil. I expect people in Israel probably have similar criticisms of the Palestinian Hamas regime. But, I mean, they're both democratically elected, so... I mean, is the word evil?
Yes.
Bit...
Well, evil is a strong word, but I wouldn't take it back. I wouldn't. Well, the things they do are evil, and I think you cannot have peace unless you have justice.
Yeah. So, I mean, some would say, it's six of one and a half dozen of the other. Surely.
No, it's not. I'll tell you why. Because it's a power relation. Mm-hmm. You know, on one hand, you have the fourth largest military machine in the world.
Yep.
I mean, we're pretty certain they have nuclear weapons. That's another issue.
Definitely, but a first
very,
world standard of
they're
living.
They're a very high tech army. Mm-hmm. They're armed to the teeth. They're illegally occupying someone else's country.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been on Palestinian land since 1967. They refuse to move. In fact, in contravention of the Geneva Conventions, they are putting their own settlements and their own people on that land, which is illegal.
Yeah.
They are gradually making that land their own. They're grabbing the water, they're grabbing the crops, they're grabbing the land.
But as you say, regarding a power relation...
So, well, the Palestinians have very little comeback. You know, they are living in a big prison, both in the West Bank with the checkpoints and in Gaza. And they are very vulnerable to being shot.
Mm.
I mean, almost every month you will hear of a child going to school being beaten up by settlers or some people, you know, trying to walk across a field, which just happens to be their field, being shot and killed. And the Palestinians have very little redress against the wrongs that are done to them. I mean, the analogy really would be the Native Americans in the 19th century and what was being done to them by the white settlers. They are very, very vulnerable to a very brutal military occupation.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about where you're taking this next. I mean, you've done the convoy. You come to talk to us. What other things are you doing following the convoy?
Well, I've been a member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign for going on 9 years now. And we in Bristol are quite active. There is, as you probably know now, an international boycott campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just PSC, but some churches, many faith groups. There's an organization called Sabil, which is involved, trade unions around the world. We're all calling for a boycott of Israeli goods until the Palestinians have justice. Because as I say, I don't see how you can have peace on a basis of injustice. You've got to do justice to people. You've got to say you've got a right to live. You've got a right to keep your land. You've got a right to live in dignity and security.
Yeah.
And then we will have peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But I think to, you know, to waken the rule, they're not the rulers, but the people, you know, who have the power in Israel, we really do have to, you know, make it economically uncomfortable until they start to say this is actually bad for us.
Where can where and when can people get, you know, hear more about you talking about this if people want to go and see you speaking publicly?
We do have public talks. There's, if you go on the internet, Palestine Solidarity Campaign on the internet.
Yeah.
Viva Palestina also has a website. Bristol Goers a link, because we are building, this is the positive thing, we do the boycott, but we're also building community links with people in Gaza.
Okay, so they Google
as
those.
As a Quaker, our area meeting has set up a link with the Baptist Church in Gaza.
Okay,
and
brilliant.
One of the things we did when we went with the convoy was we gave them a van, a minivan.
But if they put Bristol Gaza link into your favoured search engine, you'll be able to find out more and hopefully come
you
and
will
see,
indeed,
come
yes,
see talks
yes.
and go to meetings.
And about school children links and with the hospitals there.
Yep.
You know, I'd love to have had time to say a bit more about that. But, I mean, we do have a lot of good community links, and the people in Bristol have been magnificent. I mean, they gave so much to that convoy, and it all got delivered into Gaza, which was great.
Okay, well, Monica Margaret Jones, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off there, but thank you very much for coming in, and it was very interesting to hear, and hopefully we'll be able to hear more in the future.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio Mr. David Barnby, a researcher from Witney in Oxfordshire. Hello.
Hello there, John.
We've got a topic today for which you'd like to discuss, the European Movement and the IBM. IBM have a controversial contract between themselves and Avon and Somerset Police, Taunton Deane Borough Council and North Somerset District Council, and IBM is part of the topic for today. So tell me a little bit about the European Movement specifically, not the European Union, but the European Movement.
Well, a movement generally to me implies a spontaneous desire of people to achieve a goal.
Okay.
In other words, a grassroots pressure group. Mm-hmm. But nothing could be more further from the truth about the European Movement. It's an organised front for big business, or has been in the past and tends to be today.
Okay.
The EM, or European Movement, in fact, often acts more like a quango, and at the time it had his successful campaign to get us into the European Union. It was financed by the government, worked with the government as a department of the Foreign Office.
Okay, so it was an official organisation as such?
No, it pretended to be unofficial. It pretended to be a grassroots organisation.
But, oh, I see.
But I've done the research, gone to the Public Record Office and found out something somewhat different.
Okay.
And it came under the Information Research Department, which is a secret department of the Foreign Office. And they did such things as preparing material for the European Movement. Their civil servants would prepare letters for the press, and ordinary members of the public ordinary members of the European Movement who were somewhat duped into what they were doing, mm-hmm. would put these letters into the press. Okay. So you'd see a letter from Mr. Smith raving on about the benefits of joining the European Movement,
okay.
or joining the European Union, when this letter was in fact written by a civil servant behind the scenes.
So
I'm talking about the early 70s.
Conspiracy, you believe, to infiltrate the press to make it appear that there are lots of members of the public who are all clamouring to join the EU.
You call it a conspiracy. Yes, one could, I suppose, call it a conspiracy. I mean, let's see some of the things that they did. This quote from the Public Record Office.
Okay.
The Foreign Office Information Research Department was mobilised to provide advice and help to the European Movement. Norman Redaway, head of IRD, he's now dead, had the capacity to produce letters for the campaign, but didn't have the machinery to get them into the public domain. So the European Movement undertook this work and received substantial government funding to do so. You know, some grassroots organisation that. Another example is the Foreign Office IRD department wrote letters to the European Movement to place in the press and were mobilised to provide ideas for reply to the European Movement.
Okay, so how is this relevant today? Is it still going on?
The problem with knowing what's going on is that the records are always buried away for 30 years under the 30-year rule.
Right, okay.
So
we're not quite sure what is happening right now.
No. What I do know, though, if I may say so, is that we know that the Home Office's time operates a department called the Research Information Communications Unit. This was revealed by The Guardian a year or so ago, and they're doing the same sort of thing today. So when you see letters in the press which come from an ordinary Joe Blow, they may well be written by a civil servant. So there's a bit of deception going on.
And how is this linked into IBM?
Well, I think we have to get to the history of the European movement. It was Churchill's brainchild after he lost the 1945 election in the landslide Labour victory. I think he was twiddling his thumbs a bit and wondering what to do. So he dreamt up a united Europe and started and recommended or suggested the European Union, what it was then called, a united goal for united Europe. But of course, he wasn't interested in Britain becoming part of that because he thought we were better linked to America and the Commonwealth. Things have changed since then. Then his son-in-law, Duncan Sandys, got interested in this, and he was the main driving force of this. But the whole project lacked finance and a proper drive, although they did have some key meetings around Europe. It was beginning to falter. So Duncan Sandys went across to the United States to drum up some money and some support, enter ACU, the American Committee for United Europe. And this was consisted of many large corporations, the most notable of which is IBM, which is where we come to IBM. Now, when you look at IBM, IBM invented the punch card system where you could it was a sort of primitive type of manual computing system where you could punch the details of people onto the card. And of course, when Hitler came to power in 1933, he was very interested in doing a complete census of the population.
And how did they become involved with the European movement?
They became involved with the European movement because they jumped onto the bandwagon when Sandys went across to the States. They said, yeah, we'll come and help you start the European movement. Because this was at the end of the war. They were looking for new ways to project their influence by big money contracts. So,
and how do you believe that they projected their influence? How do you manage? How do you believe that the EU has become moulded by corporate interests?
Well, that's another subject, really. But I think a lot of people think that the European Union is driven by corporate business. I mean, most of the regulations that and directives that come from the European Union are anti. Or small business. Small business has always suffered because the rules are made for big business. But of course, the propaganda side of things pushes that the European Union is good for people. But in actual fact, it's still today.
You believe the European movement is allowing corporate interests to lobby more than they would be able to otherwise for their interests?
I think the average person who joins the European movement doesn't really realise what he's joined. It's the people behind it. I mean, the people who run it are people like Douglas Hurd, who's been the president of it, and Liam Britton, and those sort of people who are very strong Europhiles. I mean, I've got nothing.
If people wanted to find out more about the European movement, what would you recommend them to do?
I've produced this information from public records, which became released 4 or 5 years ago, which had been. There's a moratorium on the records for 30 years, and that's in this CD I produce called Chewed Horn into the EU.
With a lovely picture of Ted Heath on the front,
that's right.
Eating the cake.
And there's a section in there, I mean, this covers a wide ground, but there's a section in there which covers the activities of the European movement at the time we went into the European Union in 1972.
How can people get hold of this CD? How can people?
Well, I can't actually sell it because it's public record office material.
Right.
So what I generally do, if somebody is interested in getting it, I give it to them for free, but ask them to pay the costs of producing it, which is 63 pence per CD plus the postage.
Plus the postage.
But it's a very good read.
Okay, and how can people get in touch with you?
They can email me at my internet address, which is Dave Barnby, D-A-V-E, B-A-R-N-B-Y at AOL.com.
Dave Barnby at AOL.com.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Dave. I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there. But yeah, email me if you want to find out more about the European movement and find out more.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce to the studio Mr. Simon Chapman. Hello.
Hello there.
You're here to chat about the Digital Economy Bill that's been going through on Tuesday the 16th. That's gone through. So how long has this been? What are your sort of qualifications and interest in this, I suppose I should start off by saying?
Okay, I'm a photographer, professional photographer, so I make my living out of selling photographs. Mm-hmm. Also a member of the NUJ, National Union of Journalists. But speaking of personal capacity, I might add, the Digital Economy Bill has only gone through the House of Lords because it was introduced by Lord Mandelson.
Yeah,
it had to go to Lords first, but all bills should go through both Houses of Parliament before
Indeed.
Receiving royal assent. So it's been through the Lords with various amendments. It now should go to the Commons, most likely next week. However, with the forthcoming general election, it is quite likely that there will be what's called the wash-up, where as the election looms, and MPs kind of forget about anything except saving their own skins, or, you know, being re-elected to represent their constituents.
Right, yes.
Bills suddenly get basically shoved through Parliament as quickly as possible in order to get them out of the way so that they can get on with the business of the election.
There has notably been quite a lot of that in the past few weeks. An awful lot of bills sort of stackpiling up at the last minute.
Well, this is it. It's a problem for the government. They're desperate to get some of these bills through, including the Digital Economy Bill. And if it was to sort of fall, you know, it would be embarrassing. And the worry is that parts of the bill will go through with very little parliamentary scrutiny. You know, the Commons will hardly debate it at all. There won't be any chance to sort of amend it at the Commons stage.
Right.
And there may be very little debate.
Okay, so I mean, this is a potentially extremely important bill, the Digital Economy Bill.
Mm.
And there was a recent Panorama special on the TV that discussed aspects of it. So, I mean, I remember being told that during the debate about whether we should ban fox hunting, they spent 700 hours of parliamentary time discussing this, and they're going to have very little time whatsoever to discuss this. So, broadly, what is the Digital Economy Bill, and why is it important? Why should we care?
It's a very big bill with a lot of different parts, one of which is about file sharing, where the government is trying to protect some of the creative industries, particularly music and films, from losing money to people who are downloading the material without paying for it. So on the one hand, the government is therefore protecting the intellectual property rights of big business.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is a slightly obscure section, which most people have never heard of, called, it's now Section 43 of the bill, about orphan works and collective licensing. An orphan work is a work, it could be a book, but it tends to be sort of photos and illustrations where the author is not credited. You know, it could be on the internet, it could be in a magazine.
Okay, so this particular is where you might come in. You
know, exactly. Like, yeah. It directly affects my business and the business of all photographers and illustrators.
Mm-hmm.
If someone wants to use a photo, you know, they should see who the photographer is and contact them.
Yeah.
However, if that photo is somewhere without the photographer's name, what some people are asking to do is the right to use it, even though they can't contact the photographer to ask permission. Without the name of the person who created the work, it could be deemed an orphan work. It's an orphan, the parent is not known or not contactable.
Yeah.
I mean, my immediate response to that is, well, if you don't know who the photographer is, find another photograph whose parent you can find.
I mean, what if there's only one particular suitable photograph? You know, say there's an abusive power, there's a photograph of a policeman engaged in some violence or something like that. You know, there may not be another photograph to use. There's going to be an obvious temptation to really wish to use this photo.
I think that's unlikely. There's so many photos out there covering just about every conceivable subject.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a particularly famous photo, it's going to be fairly easy to find out who took it. The worry is that a lot of big businesses will use orphan works to actually stop paying normal fees to photographers and basically trying to use photos for free or on the cheap.
Okay. I mean, is there not, you know, if somebody is using a photo, even if they don't necessarily know that it's yours, I mean, it's further advertising for you, surely. I mean,
your name's not on it.
Yeah.
Yeah? How can it be advertising
for you?
Because
you can then contact the people who are using it and make yourself known, surely.
Well, part of the problem is finding it in the sort of maze of the digital age. Mm. You know, it could be anywhere on sort of so many different places.
Yeah.
Also, under current UK legislation, there's no automatic right to credit photographers. This is a problem. This is the current legislation basically creates orphans almost as soon as the photos are taken. If it's put in a newspaper or magazine, they don't have to put your name by it.
Okay, so you're thinking that should have been something which should have been introduced.
Well, yes, the NUJ has long been campaigning to have what's called inalienable moral rights. Moral rights is partly the right to be credited and also the right not to have your work used.
As they would have on the inside front cover of a book or a novel.
Yes.
The author assesses his moral right over these publications.
Exactly so.
So a photographer doesn't have the same rights. I mean, what grounds to appeal to push your point have you got as a photographer? Or, you know, how long have we got until this bill comes through?
Well, very little. We've only got a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, basically to contact your MPs and ask them to oppose this particular clause, Clause 43 as it is now, it's just been renamed, on orphan works and collective licensing.
Okay, so if people did, you know, if there are other photographers and people who are interested in this, who might want to get in touch with you and say, yeah, I'm interested in trying to do something about this Clause 43, where could they go?
Well, the best place to go is a website called copyrightaction.com. Which is for photographers and photograph users, as the strapline says. It's got a load of information on there, including draft model letters to send to your MP.
Okay, brilliant. Well, Simon Chapman, thank you very much for chatting about that. We're now going to hear from the Unite Against Fascism movement about the forthcoming march by the English Defence League in Bolton on Saturday. And I'd like to speak to Nimbu Bhattacharya on the line now. Hello.
Hi there.
So tell me a little bit about the English Defence League, for those who are ignorant. Are they sort of related to the BNP? Is this what we're kind of talking about?
They certainly have a bit to the BNP. Some of their key members are BNP activists. They claim that they're not related to the BNP, but this is lies on their part. They claim that they're not a racist or a violent organisation. These are also lies on their part.
Mm-hmm.
They really emerged in May last year in Luton. They basically kind of, under the banner of claiming to be marching against so-called Islamic extremism, they actually went on the rampage in Luton, attacked Asian shops, attacked passing shoppers.
Okay, so there's a definite link to criminal activity with them.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so what is that? What are they claiming this march in Bolton is about?
Well, they've been holding a series of marches and rallies in various towns around the country over the past few months. The most recent was in Stoke in January, where again they ran riot, attacking Asians, attacking shops that employed black people, attacking police officers and cars, and basically these are racist riots. They're designed to intimidate Muslims in particular and ethnic minorities in general. They've been doing this for the past few months. The intention is to whip up hatred and violence in our streets, really.
Okay, so So tell me a little bit, how active are the English Defence League in Bristol specifically?
Well, they're organised very much strongly through the football hooligan scene. So basically, wherever you've got a club that's got an active hooligan element, they'll organise through that. So I suspect they haven't actually done any marches directly in Bristol yet, though. We've seen them, for instance, they have, for quite often when they turn up on their marches, they have divisions, so-called, which is where they come from. So there were people wearing shirts saying English Defence League Bristol Division.
Okay, so there's a sort of military element to it.
Yes, very much so, or one of the military elements at any rate.
I mean, why do you think they're getting support? I mean, is this, due to sort of immigration, for example? All the three main parties have allowed sort of possibly too much immigration to supply cheap labour. I mean, is this the main cause of their...
Well, I think the main cause is really the sort of tidal wave of anti-Muslim prejudice that we've seen in the media over the past 5-10 years. I mean, you've seen the growth of a series of... basically, it's on the fringe of the right. It's not like everyone believes this, but there's been a distinct growth of a fringe of quite crazy conspiracy theories around Muslims and around Islam.
Yeah.
The notion that Islam is somehow at war with the West, that all Muslims are somehow secret sleepers for Al-Qaeda and what have you.
Right.
I mean, structurally, if you look at history, it's very, very similar to the kind of conspiracy theories that people said about Jews at the end of the 1900s.
I mean, as I understand, you're the press officer for Unite Against Fascism. I mean, how much support are you getting?
Well, we feel that I mean, the English Defence League tried to cash in on a kind of a popular wave of Islamophobia in the press. But the fact is, the vast majority of people in this country don't really buy into this stuff. The vast majority of people in this country, when they look at what the English Defence League do, when they look at photos of them making Sieg Heil salutes, Nazi salutes, they know that these people are racist and these people are fascists, and that you know, whatever the complexities of the argument, these people are out to cause trouble.
Okay.
So we've had very positive reactions from people.
Okay, brilliant. I'm afraid I've kind of got to wrap things up rather rapidly, I'm afraid, Nimbo, but you are findable on the internet quite easily, I would assume?
Yes, if you go to www.uaf.org.uk.
uaf.org.uk, brilliant. Nimbo Bhattacharya, thank you very much for talking to us today, and keep your eyes open, folks.
Okay, cheers.
Well, this is a song by The Clash, and see if you can spot the connection with the interview that's going to come up. It's Lost in the Supermarket. Well, that was The Clash from 79, from the double album London Calling, and that was Lost in the Supermarket. At this point, I'd like to introduce an interview. This is courtesy of Alex. He's a squatter who was residing in, stroke on, the former Jester's building on Stokes Croft, Cheltenham Road, which is a proposed Tesco site. They attempted an eviction last week, and then on Tuesday the 16th of March they tried again and succeeded, and Alex was one of the squatters, was there being interviewed as the eviction happened. Obviously you'll expect there is a bit of atmosphere and stuff going on in the background for that, so we apologise.
My name's Alex, and I've been a little bit kind of involved with the No to Tesco campaign. We've been occupying a proposed site for a Tesco on Stokes Croft for the last month, a little bit more than a month, in protest against the lack of any public consultation in the community. And today we were forcibly evicted from the site.
I mean, did you have any method of trying to stay in the building as the bailiffs turned up?
We had a number of methods. I spent some time on the tripod and some time glued, super glued to a ladder that was leaned up against the wall.
Super gluing yourself, that's quite an extreme measure. Why did you do that?
Ever since I come to Stokes Croft in Bristol, you know, I really feel like I really love this community, and I've lived in other communities. I used to live in Oxford, and I saw what happened when multinational companies started coming and taking over the high street. In East Oxford, and it just ruined the whole vibe, because suddenly there was a new class of people moving in. All of the small shops, the local businesses and family businesses all closed down, and I'm not going to see that happen to Stokes Croft.
Well, that was Alex. That was one of the squatters living in stroke on the former Jester's building on Stokes Croft, which is of course the site of a proposed Tesco's. And I've got Simon Chapman, who I spoke to earlier on regarding the Digital Economy Bill, who's a photographer, and I understand you were using your skills as the eviction was going on. Tell us about that.
I was, yes. I'd been keeping sort of tabs on it since I occupied the building, and got an alert this morning when I happened to be up in quite a way away in Gloucestershire doing another job, so I sort of rushed back down to sort of find the eviction in progress. And I managed to get up onto the roof of the building, courtesy of Fred Baker's Cycles, along with various other media people. And we were sort of filming and photographing from the roof, sort of looking down on the flat roof immediately above the old Jester's Comedy Club, where various of the squatters, protesters, had sort of locked themselves on in various ways to resist the eviction.
Right.
So it was quite spectacular. Sort of, you know, you could get a view of the road, the crowd, the police horses in an arc, okay. The cherry picker.
So did they, were they relatively sort of fair, the police, do you think? How was it?
I don't know. I think police seemed relatively fair. There were some arrests, I'm not quite sure. There were some scuffles and people being led away. I'm not quite sure exactly why, because most of the time I was up quite high.
Mm.
Obviously, the bailiffs were doing the actual eviction on the roof. They would sort of cut the locks off the protesters and then they'd put them in a cherry picker, or sometimes forcibly, sort of loading them in sort of sideways, as it were, and then they'd take them down in the cherry picker where the police would then lead them away.
Right.
I understand there's some question as to whether it's actually legal to sort of take people down in a cherry picker like that, but anyway, that's what happened. And it took from, say, sort of 10 o'clock, I think, when the eviction started, till about 3 in the afternoon, or even 4, a bit beyond that, to get everyone off. In fact, at one point, it lasted until nearly 5. And it closed the road as well, so it was quite a big event.
Tony, how were you involved in this at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know some of the people who were in there. I've spoken to them as well. I just think that it's important to understand why Tesco's have been singled out and taken on. I think it's because there's lots of local shops around that area that supply the similar sorts of things that Tesco's supply, and they are all really annoyed that another Tesco's is appearing. I mean, a half mile up the road, there's Tesco's, another half mile down the road, there's two more Tesco's. Mm-hmm. So this is really going to quite possibly mean an end to several local shops around there. There's a big housing development that's just appeared next door to where this proposed Tesco's is, and this is aimed at them, but it is going to have a very detrimental effect on local traders, and this is one of the reasons why the people are getting so annoyed about it, because it's not just the protesters, it's very many of the local residents, a vast majority of them, don't want a Tesco's there.
So you don't think that Tesco's are going to be sympathetic to the local culture?
Well, they have been quite naughty, really, in that the original consultation didn't say anything about the fact that it was going to actually be a Tesco's shop. Many of the local people thought it's just going to be a small, locally owned convenience store that was appearing, and there was nothing to say it was Tesco's when local people were consulted, so they quite rightly feel cheated by Tesco's. For anyone that's interested in the sorts of tactics that Tesco's use to get their planning permission and mm-hmm. to get successful new stores like this, there's a documentary called Tesco, the Store That's Eating Britain, which was made about 18 months ago by Channel 4's Dispatches, which you can watch on the internet.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm sure many people will look that up as soon as they're here. Well, thank you very much to both Tony and Simon. So do you think it's fairly inevitable now that we're definitely going to have a Tesco's? Is that it?
Well, one thing that the protesters are saying, and that speaking to Alex beforehand, he didn't want to go into any details, but he said this is certainly not the end of the campaign. The fact that they've been evicted just means that they're going to be changing their tactics.
Okay, brilliant. All right, well, thank you very much to both of you. The next song we've got for you is by Lucy Phillips, who has just started her first year at the University of Chichester, where she will be studying music. And this is her performing I Could Have Danced All Night. I'll never know. Well, there you go. Courtesy of Dialect Radio, us playing more local music than most of the other local radio stations. That was Lucy Phillips, who's just started her first year at the University of Chichester, where she's studying music, as you will have guessed, and that was I Could Have Danced All Night. Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Geoffrey Ahern. He's a fellow at Exeter University, and he here talks about leadership and sustainability.
Geoffrey Ahern, I've been involved in the area of sustainability for some time. I'm a fellow at Exeter University, and I'm involved in the leadership aspects of sustainability.
Can you tell us a bit more about leadership then?
Yes, it's a study of how people exercise leadership in organisations and elsewhere, the various theories involved, but linking them very much to practice, because of course it is a very practical subject.
Are you linked with business at all?
Yes, very much so. And business is a major buyer of courses and also facilitation to do with sustainability.
How can people in business change their viewpoint?
How can they change their viewpoint?
Towards sustainability, being less wasteful and more community proactive.
Well, it's important that the board buy into change, because otherwise enthusiasts within the company, and there'll always be plenty of people who aren't enthusiastic, won't be able to get there, do anything about it. So one of the key things is to get the board on board with it. And then there are various stages in implementing it. You start off usually in niches, so parts of the company adapt to sustainability, or you have the relatively quick hits, which also make money for the company. But then there comes a point where there needs to be organisational transformation, where the whole thing needs to be put on a more sustainable basis. And that's the tricky bit. It needs to be right in terms of the internal goings-on, but also it needs to be right in terms of the outside, because you can transform internally, but if the market and the external environment isn't ready to meet that, then you can have problems.
How much opposition have you had from businesses with regard to this project?
Less than you'd think. I think businesses have taken the initiative to the government. They've done something quite unusual. Heads of businesses have got together, gone to Downing Street and said, look, you've got to make some laws about this. Their trouble is that if one business becomes sustainable, it might be more costly for them. The other businesses need to do the same. It's what's known as a prisoner's dilemma. And to solve that, you really need to get together and have the same rules for all. And they've taken the initiative to do it to Downing Street some years ago. We're now waiting for the government to... It's made a good start in many ways of Ed Miliband, I think, but it's a late start and it needs to do a lot more to regulate this whole area.
Can you think of any companies which are outstanding in this field?
Well, there's some well-known companies which have had the courage to go over the parapet, like Marks and Spencer's. I'm not in a position to say in any particular company like that how well they're doing, either because they're a client and I wouldn't, or because I don't have knowledge of them in sufficient detail. But there have been case studies on companies which have gone a long way through transformation and beyond. So there are examples out there of companies which have gone a long way and have done very well.
Could you briefly sketch over the varieties of sustainability?
Fascinating question, because people... Sustainability means so many different things to different people. And one of the key things, I think, that needs to happen is that there needs to be more understanding of the various perspectives on it and the coming together of them. Very briefly, you've got people who come from the environment itself, peak oil, peak water, biosphere threatened, and, of course, climate change. But then you've got the economic approach to it. Tim Jackson's book, for example, on it, which says we just cannot carry on growing the way we are, and that we have to, the economy actually has to contract in terms of its use of material stuff. And then there's the fairness and social aspect. People come at it from the point of view of we need to be sustainable in the sense we need to have corporate social responsibility, we need to have fairness within organisations and companies, also outside. So coming at it from many different angles, a synthesis hasn't really yet, I think, had time to take place. But because of the urgency of the environmental situation, it really needs to. Another aspect in this is how actually you cannot, I think, have proper environmental sustainability unless you also have social fairness, at least within the company you're dealing with or within the country you're in. And the idealists, and I'd agree with them, say that this needs to be global as well, though we're going to see what happens.
Well, thank you to Anthony Page and Geoffrey Ahern for the reference there, and that was Geoffrey talking about leadership and sustainability. Time for another instalment of Headstrimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village. And it's read here by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
Trimmings by A.G. Street. Very idle thoughts. The other day, I accepted an invitation to lunch with the... No. On second thoughts, I shall not reveal the identity of my hosts. That they were sufficiently endowed with tact and discernment to invite me to lunch shows that they were the right sort of people. For if they had not been the right sort of people, they might have invited you instead. Which, as Euclid says, would have been absurd. Nor do I think it necessary to talk about the luncheon itself, nor of my conduct during the repast. Suffice it to say that it was a good luncheon, and that my own behaviour was irreproachable. Sometimes I confess it, my behaviour is not all that it might be. Both before and at breakfast, for instance, I am not always a little ray of sunshine in the home. But at a luncheon, I am a perfect little gentleman. Anyway, on this occasion, I enjoyed my lunch, thanked my hosts most sincerely, and returned home at about 3 o'clock. But it is of the after effects of that luncheon that I feel constrained to talk. Of course, the time of my return home was unfortunate. What can you begin to do on a farm after 3 o'clock? The afternoon milking was well underway, and I had on my best suit. To change into working clothes and start any job at that hour seemed hardly worthwhile. Besides, it had been a good luncheon. I felt at peace with the world. I would therefore review the agricultural position. You need to be in a good humour to do that in these days, and in any humour the best place from which to do it is obviously from the depths of a large armchair. Having got comfortably settled, I mused on the weather, its effect on the season's farming, and the chances of getting a favourable winter. At what point in these reflections I fell asleep, I do not know. But in my sleep I dreamed a horrible dream. In this vision, the non-farming population of our land had discovered that, if all the people engaged in agriculture were to be exterminated, there would always be fine weather for the nation's amusements. Imagine the result. In 3 days there was hardly a farmer or farm worker left alive in the whole country. The massacre of St. Bartholomew was a flea bite by comparison. This little job having been carried out satisfactorily, the nation settled down to the serious business of life. The weather was ideal. The wickets were always perfect. The season was superb, hiking heavenly, golf gorgeous, boating benign, tennis top hell. Strikes were a thing of the past, and foreign countries dumped food into our land as of yore. In a few years, only an odd farmer or two existed, and these were hunted down ruthlessly. There were notes in the papers, something like this. Rare specimen of farmer shot in the New Forest. Thanks to the bravery and determination of Detective Inspector Pengelly, a farmer was discovered and shot near Lyndhurst yesterday afternoon. It is interesting to recall that a few years ago this pest was prevalent throughout the country, with disastrous effect on our weather conditions. On page 14 will be found an account of a sparkling century by our evergreen Hobbs, which he compiled at the Oval yesterday in brilliant sunshine. In the early days of his cricketing career, matches were often abandoned owing to the inclement weather caused by the farming pest. And I awoke, terrified. It had all seemed so reasonable and so real. But I was still alive, and the rain was pattering down the window as of old. Thank heaven it was only a dream. But there it is. People view weather conditions differently. When the farmer wants rain, hardly anyone agrees with him. But when wet weather is spoiling his crops, he is sure of public sympathy. I can remember one wet August meeting a town friend in my club, and he was greatly concerned over the damage the rain was doing to the corn crops in the neighbourhood. In fact, he was much more worried about it than I. He got quite worked up over the tragedy of it all. He mourned over the wheat. He almost wept over the barley. Large, sympathetic tears stood in his eyes, so I stood him a drink to prevent him from breaking down completely. I found out afterwards that he was the leading spirit on the committee responsible that week for an annual cricket festival in the neighbourhood. But that is by the way. He got that drink under false pretences. Still, at the present moment, two things are certain. One is that, although the bulk of our population never wants any rain, the farmer must have some occasionally. Let us hope that Providence, as in the past, will be able to satisfy both parties without having recourse to such drastic methods as depicted in my dream. What is the other? Surely it is obvious. Very certainly, I ought not to go out to lunch.
Well, thank you very much to the honeyed tones of Malcolm Greaves, live from Swindon, for his excellent reading of Hedge Trimmings. More next week. Right, well, it's lovely. Time for Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hello.
Hello again, John.
Ah, you're a frequent visitor here, and we enjoy you every week. What have you got for us this time?
This week, it's not a political thing. It's commenting on an article in The Guardian on last Saturday.
The Grawny ad.
Yes. And the poet laureate has invited ageing poets to write about ageing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a collection of poems on ageing.
Okay.
And this is a comment on that. I wasn't, in fact, she didn't invite me because maybe I'm not quite qualified enough yet. You know. This is an ode to ageing poets. Through all the thoughts that old poets reflect on, one can smell a sense of melancholy. One detects detachment in introspection when musing on foibles and past folly. This musty fruit of maturation gives encouragement to those not yet there. We too will manage the situation and think, well, okay, we've had our share. The amusement of continuation shines through the words and lightens up the verse, transmits acceptance and resignation. Aging's tough, but the alternative's worse. Pick up a pen before you grow too old. Try to find your own words, just have a go. Perhaps there's something there that should be told. The things we never try, we'll never know.
And thank you to the Bard of Windmill Hill. Tell us a little bit briefly about your book. You've had a book published and you don't mention it much.
The book's still around.
Yeah?
The book's still around.
Okay, what's
Diamonds
it called?
In the Desert, yes.
Diamonds in the Desert.
Diamonds in the Desert, yes. It's available from Waterstones. Can I just mention the cabaret coming up next month?
Excellent.
This is a little snippet from the Lansdowne Cabaret website. The proclamation. So the show is next month, the 9th and 10th, at the Lansdowne, Clifton Road.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone would like to make a reservation, call me on 0117 966 5514. Entertainment on all fronts for only £7. There is no other show like this. This is a show too good to miss. Transport your senses into bliss. Come to the cabaret. If you enjoy a great night out, you will love this. I have no doubt I know what I am on about. I'm in this cabaret. The people who've been there before are always queuing at the door. Once you've been, you will want more of Lansdowne Cabaret.
The charming, twinkly-eyed, ever-youthful Trevor Carter there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time once again to welcome Jeff Sparks, who's going to be telling us what's going on in Bristol this week. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 24th of March, Nick Harper will be performing with support from Georgia Ruth at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £10 each. Also on 24th of March, Trivium will be performing with support from Chimera, Whitechapel and Rise to Remain. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £16.50 in advance. Moving on to Thursday, 25th of March, Kill It Kid will be performing with support from the John E. Vistick Experience and also the Doubtful Guest at Moles Club in 14 George Street, Bath. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 for NUS and £5 for everyone else. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Spit Like This. This is from their debut album, We Won't Hurt You, But We Won't Go Away, which was released in 2008, and is the track Down On You.
Hello there, listeners. I'm going to let you into a secret everyone should know. Doesn't matter what anyone else tells you, this is completely not a fact. So pay attention to me.
That was Spit Like This with Down On You from the album We Won't Hurt You, But We Won't Go Away. For more information on them, you can check out www.spitlikethis.com. Into Friday, 26th of March, Poodles of Doom will be performing at the Oxford in Oxford Street, Totterdown, Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 26th of March, Who's Next, the UK's premier tribute to The Who, will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. On Saturday, 27th of March, The Bones will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 28th of March, Rick Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show. Thank you to our studio guests. We had Monica Margaret Jones from the Bristol Gaza Link. We had Dave Barmby, an independent researcher from Oxfordshire, and Simon Chapman, a photographer. Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves. As ever, he read Hedge Trimmings wonderfully by A.G. Street, and the features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. We had a poem courtesy of Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and Dialect Radio, of course, and not forgetting What's On by Jeff Sparks. Looking forward to the Poodles of Doom? I know we are. The studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman. Take care.